is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Israel's military announced a tactical pause on Sunday in a daytime fighting around a critical aid route in Gaza. Plan falls short of a total ceasefire outlined by U.S. President Joe Biden.
From 5 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon and until further notice, the pause aims to grant safe passage of aid trucks bringing much-needed supplies to Gaza. Welcome news to aid groups struggling for months to deliver life-saving supplies. Deputy Executive Director of the UN World Food Program, Carl Scow.
Here we have really a protection disaster and a water and sanitation catastrophe. People are camping on the streets, on the beach, at best with some piece of shelter. But we were driving through rivers of sewage.
Arash Arbasadi, VOA News.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's two-day weekend summit at a Swiss alpine resort aimed to find a consensus on how to end the war in Ukraine. Many Western leaders voiced condemnation of Russia's invasion and rejected President Vladimir Putin's demands for parts of Ukraine as a condition for peace. Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo.
A draft of the final declaration seen by Reuters refers to Russia's invasion as a war, a label Moscow rejects. It calls for Ukraine's control over the Zaporizhia nuclear plant and its Azov seaports to be restored and for Ukraine's territorial integrity to be respected. But in line with the conference's more modest stated aims, it omitted tougher issues on what a post-war settlement for Ukraine might look like and whether Ukraine could join the NATO alliance. The Kremlin did not rule out future talks with Kyiv, but said guarantees will be needed to ensure the credibility of any negotiations. Whether there will be a follow-up to the summit and where it will be held remained unclear.
That's Reuters' Alice Rizzo reporting. This is VOA News. A Chinese vessel and a Philippine supply ship collided near the disputed Spratly Islands in the South China Sea Monday. That's according to China's Coast Guard. The Coast Guard said that a Philippine supply ship entered waters near the Second Thomas Shoal, a submerged reef in the Spratly Islands that's part of territory claimed by several nations. Chinese Coast Guard said in a statement, the social media platform WeChat, the Philippine supply ship, ignored China's repeated solemn warnings and dangerously approached a Chinese vessel in normal navigation in an unprofessional manner, resulting in a collision. Over a dozen Jordanians have died from sunstroke during the Hajj pilgrimage, according to Jordan's media. AP correspondent Karen Shamas.
Masses of pilgrims have embarked on a symbolic stoning of the devil in Saudi Arabia under the soaring summer heat. The ritual marks the final days of the Hajj, or Islamic pilgrimage, and the start of Eid al-Adha, a celebration for Muslims around the world. The pilgrimage has not been an easy one for the over 1 million Muslims who have had to tolerate the intense heat. Whilst over a dozen Jordanians died from too much exposure to the sun, Saudi's foreign ministry has said that over 2,700 pilgrims suffered from sunstroke and heat stress on one day alone. I'm Karen Shamas.
And again, Muslims and across Iraq mark the beginning of Eid al-Adha on Sunday. It is one of Islam's two main festivals, marking the climax of the annual Hajj pilgrimage, when Muslims slaughter animals, often distributing meat to the poor. But high prices this year are now meaning fewer families are able to afford livestock for sacrifice. One trader said prices for sheep are ranging from $400 to $750. With less than 3 weeks until UK Election Day, the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is running out of time to change the ominous tune for his Conservative Party. Sunak, who in recent days traveled to a Group of Seven summit and a Swiss conference on the Ukraine war, has been dogged by questions about whether voters are about to bring his time to in office to an abrupt end on July 4th. Polls continue to give the left-of-center opposition Labour Party under Keir Starmer a double-digit lead over Sunak's Conservatives, who have been in power for 14 years under five different prime ministers. Singapore authorities say that a dredger boat reported a sudden loss in engine and steering control before it hit a cargo tanker last week, causing the oil spill that has blackened part of the city, island's southern shore. The Netherlands-flagged dredger Vox Maxima struck the Singaporean fuel supply ship Marine Honor on Friday. It ruptured one of the cargo tanks on the Marine Honor. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today Break Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, June 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South African President Ramaphosa is scheduled to be inaugurated on Wednesday and will name a government of national unity.
The ANC in the coming days will continue engagement with all parties as we move towards the steps to form the government of national unity.
Two political parties are challenging the results of South Africa's May 29th election. We'll examine the prospects for peace in Sudan. Malawi's late vice president is being laid to rest today, Monday. UNICEF says most African countries are not meeting their commitment to allocate 20% of their national budgets to education.
The right to education is clearly mentioned in the Convention on the Rights of the Child, but also the African Charter on the Rights and the Welfare of the Child states that every child shall have the right to an education.
And Biden and Trump campaign on the lessons of January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Following his election by Parliament for a second term on Friday, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa is expected to be inaugurated this Wednesday. The president is also expected to announce members of the Government of National Unity, the GNU, comprising the African National Congress, ANC, the Democratic Alliance, the DA, and the Umkhonto Freedom Party, the IFP. ANC Secretary General Fikile Mbalula briefed the media over the weekend and said all parties to the GNU agreed to uphold certain principles, including respect for the Constitution and the rule of law.
The ANC congratulates Comrade Matamela Cyril Ramaphosa on his election as President of the Republic. His election reflects the tremendous confidence of South Africans across society in his leadership. The parties working together to take forward an inclusive government of national unity have embraced a statement, quote-unquote, of intent of the 2024 government of national unity, which outlines foundational principles, a basic minimum program of priorities and modalities of the GNU. Parties continue to make inputs into the GNU statement of intent in order to reflect the broad consensus that should characterize its formation and modalities. The statement of intent categorically places the needs of South African people first, as expressed in the proposed minimum program for the seventh administration, including the focus on economic inclusion, industrialization, transformation and job creation, protection of workers and women rights, improving and extending basic services, and tackling the high cost of living, investing in people through education, skills and health, the fight against corruption and crime, and progressive foreign policy that reflects our national values and interests. Above all, parties to the GNU agrees that as we enter the next decade of freedom, we must work together and move decisively to tackle the triple challenges of poverty, unemployment, and inequality. The ANC in the coming days will continue engagement with all parties as we move towards the steps to form the government of national unity. As has already been announced, the president will be inaugurated on the 19th of August 2024 and thereafter will announce an inclusive GNU cabinet.
That was Fikile Mbalula, the Secretary General of the African National Congress of South Africa. He briefed the media over the weekend. The audio is courtesy of the ANC community media. Two political parties are challenging the results of South Africa's May 29th presidential and provincial elections. They are the Umkhonto we Sizwe, or MK Party, and the African Transformation Movement, or the ATM Party. Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst and the former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He tells me that while there may be hundreds more challenges still to come, they are not likely to change the results of the elections.
Well, the challenges are going to continue. There are 20 parties that have raised the issues, and there are about 500 objections. That is quite a large number of concerns that have been raised by at least 20 parties. ATM and the MK party are the only two that have come out to approach the courts. But the others will probably do the same as well. But the IEC is not convinced that in terms of percentage, the changes will be that material as not to declare the elections to be free and fair. So it will be once the parties present evidence that the electoral court will be able to make a determination. But what it would mean practically in case the IEC is found wanting is simply to correct the numbers. And with the correction of numbers, there'll be a correction of the allocation of seats. So for most people, this is not a train smash. What they were concerned about is the hurry and the speed with which the IEC chose to want to announce this. But as it also said, unfortunately, it said the market will be jittery if this takes long, which is itself a problem. We are not going to be governed by the markets. We pay attention to them, but they cannot be an excuse to undermine the will of the people.
Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst and the former Deputy Vice Chancellor for Institutional Support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. The United Nations Security Council has demanded a halt to the siege of Sudan's El Fasher city by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces and an immediate end to fighting. This, as the UN described the devastation as the largest displacement of a population in the world. David Shin is a professor of African Studies at George Washington University. He told VOA's Jinedu Ofor that the prospects for an immediate end to the conflict are dim because the world is not paying enough attention.
Unfortunately, many African issues do tend to get a lower priority than certain other parts of the world. European issues, at least in the American context, to get more attention. The issues in the Middle East tend to attract more interest generally than do issues in Africa. There are exceptions. I mean, you've had, for example, the very serious famine in Ethiopia in the mid-1980s. It got enormous attention in the United States, including sending of troops to Somalia. For whatever reason, the situation in Sudan has been overwhelmed by what is going on in places like Ukraine and Gaza.
Does that fit the narrative that Africa is actually not important, not just to the United States, but to Europe, for whatever reason?
I think that's overstating the case. I think Africa is deemed to be important, but it is competing with the rest of the world for attention. And if what is taking place in Sudan today were happening more or less in isolation, I think you would see a lot more attention focused on Sudan. But it's difficult for governments around the world to focus on a region that is considered to be sort of more remote. It's partly just a question of bad luck, of having this crisis break out at a time of stiff competition.
With the devastation going on and efforts thus far to bring all the parties to the table for peace, have we gotten to a point of no return?
As a former diplomat, it's hard for me to ever acknowledge that one reaches a point of no return. Diplomats are constantly looking for the bright side of solving an issue. Certainly, it has been a very dismal experience dealing with Sudan and watching the international community deal with Sudan. And it's not just Western countries. The same situation with countries like China and Russia and India. They're paying even less attention to Sudan than the West is. At least the United States and European countries are providing humanitarian aid. The U.S. is the largest provider of humanitarian aid. But in terms of a political solution, I really am pessimistic about how this is going to play out. And a lot of the problem has to do with the two factions fighting in Sudan today. The leaders of both groups seem committed to continuing with the fighting. They don't seem to be the least bit inclined to compromise on anything. And when you have that kind of a situation, it is exceedingly difficult for outside groups to have a major impact upon what is happening on the ground in the country if neither side is willing to compromise.
David Shin is professor of African Studies at George Washington University. He spoke with viewers Jinedu Ofor. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Monday, June 17th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera said he wants to know what caused the plane crash that killed Vice President Saulos Chilima and 8 other people. Chakwera spoke Sunday while delivering his eulogy for Chilima at the Bingu National Stadium, where Malawians and many international guests gather to pay their last respects to the late Vice President. Lamech Masina reports from Blantyre.
The aircraft carrying the late Vice President Chilima, who was seen as a potential candidate in the next year's presidential election, went missing last Monday in northern Malawi. On Tuesday, it was found to have crashed, killing everyone on board. In his eulogy, Chakwera said it is hard for him and all Malawians to understand the cause of the crash. He assured all Malawians that this accident would be investigated thoroughly and transparently. He says he has already asked foreign nations to assist in the matter. This is the first time in Malawi for a vice president to be killed in a plane crash. The incident has caused anger and division among Malawians, with some suggesting that Chilima was assassinated, while others say it was just an accident. The aviation authorities had earlier said the crash was caused by bad weather. The Malawi Defense Force told a press conference Thursday that they had started an investigation into the cause of the crash of its Dornier 228 plane, which would take 10 days. On Sunday, foreign dignitaries gathered to pay their last respects to the late vice president. But Chakwera told them that the military's investigation is not enough. He says he knows that the Malawi Defense Force has its own procedures to investigate what brought down their plane, but an independent and thorough investigation is necessary so that Malawians can receive trustworthy answers. During the ceremony, a group of people believed to be supporters of Chilima's party, the United Transformation Movement, continuously booed Chakwera throughout his speech. In response, Chakwera said that he knows that this is a time as the country's top political leader to expect blame and suspicion by some who are grieving. Rebecca Adadonto represented the United Nations Secretary General at the funeral ceremony. She asked Malawians to remain calm.
As we reflect on Dr. Chilima's legacy, let us honor his memory by continuing to uphold the principles and values he stood for, including peace, kindness, and compassion.
Chilima has left his wife, Mary, and his two children, Sean and Elizabeth. In his eulogy, his son, Sean, said he would continue to support the legacy of his father.
Anybody that has good memories of my dad, even though my dad is physically not here anymore, his legacy will live on in the hearts of the people he touched.
However, local media reports say about 4 people were killed Sunday night in Njeu District during a fracas which erupted when angry villagers pelted their stones at a convoy that carried Chilima's remains for burial. For VOA Africa, I am Lamech Masina in Blantyre.
Africa commemorated the Day of the African Child yesterday, Sunday. The day had its beginning on June 16, 1971, when thousands of South African students in Soweto Township marched and demanded to be taught in their own language, not the Afrikaans language of apartheid South Africa. Police responded and killed hundreds of students. The theme of this year's celebration is Education for All Children in Africa. The time is now. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, has released a report which shows that most African countries are not meeting their commitment to allocate 20% of their national budgets for education. Sasha Westerbeek is the UNICEF Chief Communication Officer. She tells me that the African government should recommit to make education a budgetary priority.
We're celebrating the Day of the African Child this year in Kiriandongo District, which hosts a large refugee population here in Uganda. And we're very honored to have been selected by the African Union to host this continental event. Now, as you know, the Day of the African Child is a very important day for UNICEF and the children across the continent. Taking you back on the 16th of June, what happened? It was in Soweto uprising in 1976. At that time, very courageous students marched for their rights to education. And their courage and their determination, they still serve as a timeless reminder and an inspiration, and urging us as all stakeholders to ensure that every child has access to an education that empowers and uplights them. So this year, the theme of the Day of the African Child is education for all children in Africa. The time is now. As we know, the aspect of education for all is key because the right to education is clearly mentioned in the Convention on the Rights of the Child, but also the African Charter on the Rights and the Welfare of the Child states that every child shall have the right to an education, despite their location, their race, their parental status, disability, gender, and any other status, including refugee children.
Sasha, you said that 9 out of 49 African countries, which is less than 1 in 5, dedicated 20% or more of their public spending to education. What does this mean for the future of the African child and the continent?
So in terms of this expenditure of governments, as you say, it's quite dramatic. And I think the time for action is very, very clear. What we see in the African continent, it's a very fast-growing school-age population. And it, as you might know, it's estimated that the continent will be home to about 1 billion children by 2050. And without urgent attention, I think the huge lack of financing for education will truly be catastrophic for a generation of students and the future economic growth and stability of the region.
I don't know whether you can address this too, but all this conflict, how does that impact the African child in terms of education?
Yes, investing in education, it really needs to start with building learning foundations for the future. And what we know, for example, as well, is that investing in early childhood education and foundational learning will benefit countries in the long run. So globally, every dollar spent on pre-primary education has an estimated return of some 9 and some $17 return for every dollar invested in the most marginalized children. And those marginalized children are those affected by conflict and by climate crisis, but also children with disabilities, children from the poorest households.
Sasha Westerbeek is UNICEF Chief Communication Officer. She was speaking with us from Kiriandongo Town, Uganda. On January 6, 2021, the U.S. Capitol building was attacked by supporters of then-President Donald Trump, challenging his loss of the 2020 election. In their rematch this year, Trump and President Joe Biden are both campaigning on the lessons of that January 6 violence, viewers Dora Mikhail reports.
The violence of January 6, 2021 is so central to Donald Trump's re-election efforts.
Donald J. Trump and the J6 Choir.
That he opened a campaign rally with a song from men convicted of attacking the Capitol that day.
You heard the hostages singing. That was the hostages. They're the J6 hostages, I call them.
Crowds cheer when Trump refers to the insurrectionists as patriots and hostages rather than as convicted criminals.
But under Joe Biden, American patriots are being arrested and held in captivity like animals.
In the song Trump recorded with the J6 prison choir, he recites the Pledge of Allegiance. Jennifer Murcia teaches communications at Texas A&M University.
It is incongruous to use the Pledge of Allegiance to support defendants of violent insurrection against the Capitol. So I think the critics are right on that regard. Of course, Donald Trump's excuse or his explanation would be that, in fact, these are real patriots.
We will treat them fairly. And if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons.
The Biden campaign is also talking about the January 6th violence, not as patriotism, but as threatening democracy.
They were insurrectionists, not patriots. They weren't there to uphold the Constitution. They were there to destroy the Constitution.
If reelected, he wants to pardon, quote, every one of them. Trump's assault on democracy isn't just part of his past. It's what he's promising for the future.
How the 2021 violence impacts voting in 2024 depends on who you are, says political scientist Chris Edelson from American University.
Some people will be galvanized by January 6th. Some people are horrified.
Biden and Trump are both using January 6th as a warning for what might happen if the wrong person is elected president. Dora McQuar, VOA News, Washington.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with tennis. South Africa has been promoted back to Tennis Europe Africa Group 2 following their 3-love victory over Kenya in the Billie Jean King Cup Group 3 tournament played in Kenya. In the women's singles, Gabriela Broadfoot saw off Cynthia Wanjala 6-3, 6-1, while Isabella Kruger beat local top seed Angela Okutoyi 7-6, 6-3. Broadfoot and Hek van Vuren then partnered in the doubles to win 6-1, 3-6, 10-4 in a thrilling contest. South Africa Gabriela Broadfoot was excited to be promoted to Europe's Africa Group 2 of the Billie Jean King Cup tournament.
So it was a tough rounds for us there, but yeah, I think this year we brought together the team spirit, and I think this week we focused a lot on supporting each other every day, so we are all really excited to be going back to Group 2.
In basketball news, Rwanda under 18 boys team lost 66-69 at the hands of host Uganda in the final of the under 18 Zone 5 qualifiers that concluded at the Lugogo Indoor Stadium in Kampala, Uganda. Despite the loss, the team alongside Uganda still secured automatic ticket to the under 18 AfroBasket Finals, which will take place in Pretoria, South Africa in August. The Junior Gazelles won the first quarter 19-17, but Rwanda bounced back and claimed the second quarter 17-10 to take a 34-29 lead at the break. And now to cycling, where the third edition of the Loop Safari Gravel Series hosted at Hell's Gate National Park in Naivasha, Kenya, witnessed an impressive turnout of over 467 elite and recreational cyclists from different nationalities across Africa, Europe, and the United States of America. Participants braved the challenging terrain, demonstrating their endurance and skill amidst the breathtaking landscapes that Kenya has to offer. In the demanding 120-kilometer elite race, Hans Becking from Netherlands clinched the top spot, clocking a remarkable time of 3 hours, 12 minutes, 59 seconds. Staying in Kenya, the Kenya beach volleyball team will leave the country on Monday ahead of the 2024 Paris Olympics Africa beach volleyball qualifiers set to serve off on the 18th to the 23rd of June in Morocco. The team has been camping in Mombasa for the last 1 week and have intensified their training at the Pride Inn Hotel in Mombasa, even as coach Ibrahim Odor decries limited preparation time. Moses Mbutia, chairman of the Kenya Beach Volleyball Commission, says they are prepared to pick one of the tickets for the Olympic Games.
Our team is busy preparing now for Olympic qualifier in Tourtan in Morocco. So we are good to go as per our coaches, what they're telling us, and we hope that the sky will be the limit.
And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, June 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am Jen Boateng, Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.